Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cloud 259 Running on Air. I'm Greg Lemelstein, and as always, I'm with my co-host, Bren Jones. This is episode 51. It's Friday, January 20th. The Dubai Marathon was just a few hours ago, and there are only a few hours left, Bren, before somebody becomes president in the U.S.
A lot has happened since our last episode, Greg. You know, we need to do these more often.
Yep. We certainly do.
Maybe then fewer things will happen.
Fewer bad things.
So on the show today, we will recap the Dubai Marathon really quickly. I'll touch upon one inspiring thing that's happening today on Inauguration Day. We will touch upon the New York City Marathon perhaps. And we have two really wonderful guests today. We're going to sort of finish part two and part three on our series of young kids who run the New York City Marathon.
Great. So, Bren, I'm here in London. I'm closer to Dubai, but you were able to watch it because it was the wee hours London time, but you were able to watch it because it was evening Thursday night in New York. So tell us about it.
Well, I think, a lot of people will come away with the impression that it was a bust, certainly people who watched it, because Kenenisa Bekele did not set a world record. He was going for the 2:02:59. He ran 2:03:03 last fall in Berlin. He was fit coming into it, apparently, but he dropped out around halfway through with a leg injury. He had fallen back earlier than that. I saw the beginning of the race, and the leaders were going out in about 2:52 per kilometer. They were going at a good clip, and though the announcers got a lot of flack on the Let's Run message board, at least they were showing every kilometer the split, which was helpful, and where it stood in terms of the world record. Mm. So I thought that was cool. And then I interviewed Tony, and then I came back and I saw the the very end of the race. And the winner was a surprise, because I think we all thought Bekele would win, but it is a story still. Tamerat Tola won. He's 25 years old, and he set a course record in a very impressive fashion. It was a warm day there. I think it's usually a warm day there, but a little warmer than ideal for racing. He ran 2:04:10. The course record, Greg, I think you said it was 2:04:23. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but this is an interesting story in part because this is also a guy who won the bronze at the 10,000 at the Olympics at Rio just last year. He's one of the guys who I was rooting for. Gosh, I hate to say this to a new Brit like you, Greg, and all of our British listeners. But, you know, I like the underdogs. One of the guys who I thought, geez, maybe this guy can take down Mo Farah. Well, didn't happen at the Olympics. But he did win this marathon very impressively. And I think, you know, he's a guy to watch in the future. And you can't, just when you think you got the marathon solved, you don't. And perhaps that goes for the people trying to handicap this stuff too. You know, I think everyone thought Bekele was going to win, and he didn't.
You know, it's amazing that someone runs 2:04:10 and it sort of may feel like a bust, as you say. But, according to Track and Field News, they always have some great stats. Ken Nakamura, Track and Field News, has a compendium of the fast times at Dubai. Of course, it's probably the fastest course in the world. Tola was the 15th guy to run a 2:04 at Dubai. And of course, he was the fastest of the 204s. The 204s also include another guy named Tola, which had me confused. There was a Tedese Tola who ran a 2:04 in 2013. That was the year when five guys ran 2:04 or better. So there's always amazing times at Dubai. But Tola, because of what you say about the 10K and the track, I think he's certainly someone to watch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a tight band at 2:04. So you think of 14 times at 2:04. That's a long way from breaking two.
Right.
So I think, I was interested to see, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if Bekele broke two? Wouldn't that be a story? But then again, I don't think Nike would want him to, because it would upstage their their other attempt at breaking two with the marathon that they're setting up this spring at a location to be determined.
Yeah, we'll be talking more about the sub-2 project for sure. But you're hitting on a really interesting point, Bren. There's the fact that there's such a tight grouping at the current standard, would indicate that it's so tough to get that extra 3 minutes. I mean, the world record is 202.57. But Kaylee, as you mentioned, has run 203.03. There's been at Boston, there's been a 203.04, I think, and some other very low 203s. So it appears that as you're getting to the limits of human performance, that might explain why there's such a tight grouping.
Yeah.
But we'll see what they do, what they come up with in the Nike labs.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, since we have two long interviews tonight, we won't delve any further into that, except right. About spring marathons. I will note that Galen Rupp and Jordan Hesse are both signed up for Boston, and Jordan Hesse just hit it out of the park in the Houston half marathon. So she's a serious threat to do very well at Boston. Galen Rupp did not start that race. He was going to, but he has plantar fasciitis apparently. So that'll need to heal for him to do well at Boston. But I noticed, Greg, that some of the commentary around that, there was a lot of surprise that Rupp would run Boston. And to that surprise, I counter with, for all those running geeks out there, reread Alberto Salazar's 14 Minutes. Because in that book that was published in 2012, he basically talks about how Rupp is destined to run Boston. Salazar says, Galen might become the American runner who could one day challenge the Africans. Starting this early, working with him over a period of years, I could help him build him into an athlete capable of winning an Olympic gold medal or a Boston Marathon. So he says that right after he starts talking about starting to train Galen when Galen was 14. So that's on page 207 for those who have the book. And then you turn to page 208. Quote, if I could systematically work with a small group of top Americans, I could deliver a runner capable of winning the Boston Marathon, I said. This is Salazar said. We wouldn't have to celebrate finishing sixth anymore. So, you know, he's talking about winning the Boston Marathon. He's talking about Galen Rupp all at the same time. I think that was definitely in the plan. You know, the course isn't flat, as Rupp is, you know, used to running on a flat track, of course. And but, you know, the time has come. I think this was in the grand plan all along.
And the grand plan, Brent, I think, as you've said, is fulfilling a bit of Salazar's own destiny or rewriting his own career in a way, right? There's some psychology there.
Yeah. I think continuing his career, you know, he had success at Boston. So I think it's extending that into the next generation of runners, post all of the African runners starting to dominate the major marathons. So yeah, no, it's, it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
I read a piece, Greg, that, at around noon today, at that point, Donald Trump will have the nuclear codes. So, well, there is an uplifting story. So there, a woman who founded a group, Harlem Runs, which I believe is 3 years old now, though I may be corrected on that. Allison Desir, she and three other women are running the 240 miles from Harlem down to Washington, D.C. I hope they're taking turns. They've got a lot of people who have joined them on this run. To raise money for Planned Parenthood. I think that Desir was hoping to do something with her energy about politics and the way they're going and trying to turn things around. So they had a goal of raising $44,000 as Barack Obama was the 44th president. Last I read, they were at nearly $80,000. So fantastic job. You know, this shows what running can do, how running can be used to motivate people and also to perhaps motivate some politics. So we hope to catch up with her or other members of that group in a future episode.
Indeed, that would be very cool.
Yeah.
Bren, before we get to the interviews, one last thing. Looking back at 2016, I think it's fitting that in such a difficult year, you and I each had crappy marathons. But it's been so long that since we taped our last show, we didn't talk about New York.
Yeah, maybe that was on purpose.
Right.
You know, in searching for what went wrong and in what went right, Greg, I believe I figured out that it has nothing to do with mileage. It has everything to do with how many podcasts we put out. The more podcasts we put out in a year, the better we fare in the marathon. So here's a call to more podcasts in 2017. I think we had a low watermark in 2016, and that's where it went. So I'll talk with Greg a little bit about my New York experience after the interviews. We'll save the worst for last. That's my recap of New York. But one more quick note before we get to these interviews. I do give a shout out to Ryan Pyle, a member of our Cloud 259 group on Strava, who always puts up consistent mileage. And, you know, after the race, I wasn't sometimes it takes a special comment to meet you where you're at after a disappointing race. And he wrote, Bren, we've all been there. And, you know, I like that because it's nice to think that as runners, we all have that experience where you just, the result really isn't what you had hoped for, but.
Including Bekele, Bren. So
including Bekele today. Yeah. It goes to show, I mean, even to the best, the marathon in particular can turn you inside out and upside down and whatnot. So without further ado, let's get to some of your topics. So first we'll run the Brad Kelly tape and then the Tony Ruiz interview. I interviewed Brad a few nights ago, and this actually was one of the great things, one of the wonderful things about the New York City Marathon for me this year was that I met Brad Kelly for the first time in the corral before the race in the local competitive holding pen. And I learned about his story. So here we go with parts 2 and 3 of our Kids Who Run Marathons. In our last episode, we spoke with Wesley Paul. And in this episode, episode 51, I'm very excited to talk with Brad Kelly of the Central Park Track Club. Brad was another child wonder in the marathon. In 1976, at the tender age of 10, Brad ran the New York City Marathon, finishing in 3 hours and 43 minutes. He ran it again several more times, and by the age of 16 in 1982, he was able to break 3, the 2:54. I met Brad, actually, in the corral of this year's marathon, where he was running the first marathon in many, many years, the first New York City marathon anyways. And I heard a little bit of his story, and it's too good not to share. A little bit more on Brad. Since turning 50, there are 12 results for Brad in the New York Roadrunners database, including the marathon. He has finished in his age group first in 5 of those 12 races, second in 4 of them, and third in 3 of them. And one of those thirds included third out of 3,774 runners in the age group at the New York City Marathon. Finally, Brad, welcome to Cloud 259.
Thanks, Bren. You're giving me some ideas. Maybe I should quit while I'm ahead here.
Yeah, one last thing. Incidentally, recently Brad was just named the 2016 Central Park Track Club Men's Masters Long Roads Award winner. So, Brad, I try to forget a lot of that marathon day. It wasn't a great one for me, but it was a good one for you in 2016. And maybe one of the highlights for me was talking to you in the corral before the race, when you told me about your first marathon there. So basically, I want to recreate the conversation. And how did you end up at the starting line of the New York City Marathon at the age of 10?
Well, it definitely wasn't of my own volition, I can tell you that. this was a day when I believe back in that day, people really didn't know some of the fundamentals about, or at least what they believe today, that, you know, maybe children shouldn't be running those distances. And I came up from a pretty competitive family. So what happened was when I probably was maybe 10 years old and a few months, my mom said, here's somebody, his name is Ephraim, he's a friend of mine, and he's going to go running today and you're going to go with him. And running to me meant sprinting across the schoolyard playing tag. I didn't even have a conceptualization of what running in terms of, you know, doing a mile or, you know, certainly not doing 26 miles meant. Mm-hmm. But I did go out on that first time, and I went around the reservoir because I grew up in Manhattan. And I'd like to say that it was love at first run, but, you know, it was full of cramps and sweat and pain. But, you know, I definitely stuck with it, and probably about 3 or 4 months after that, I'd worked up to 8 miles, being my longest run at that point. And my mom said to me, they were going to be running this thing called a marathon. It didn't, you know, I didn't know what that meant, and it was, I understood the concept of all five boroughs at that moment. So I understood that a marathon was going to be substantially, you know, greater than making a lap or two around the reservoir. And
where did you live at the time?
I lived at 55 West 95th Street, which is Columbus Avenue, an avenue from Central Park. Mm-hmm. And she signed me up. I still remember we got a little flyer about a week or so before describing the things you could expect in the marathon. And I remember they said there will be splits every 3 miles. And we actually knew so little about running at that time that we thought that meant there were going to be banana splits offered to the... So that, you know, you'd have something to nourish you along the way. And I you know, was looking for them every 3 miles. It wasn't until after the race that I found out what a split actually was.
Oh, my. And I'm sure you were pretty hungry and dispirited by the end, huh?
It was a death march.
So your mother signed you up. And do you think she had any idea what she was getting you into?
I don't think so. I think... she had not run herself at that moment. So I think it's the type of thing, you know, now people know what a marathon is. They know what it entails. But I think she just thought he's, you know, been doing fairly well running around the reservoir. And, you know, what's a few boroughs extra, you know? So,
you know, as a parent now, it's hard to fathom, you know, having my kid, you know, run alone on a track, much less through the five boroughs.
You know, it was a different time. It was mm-hmm. It was a very different city. I mean, the interesting thing is it was a much less safe city than it is today. But by the same token, you know, where I believe kids are very regimented nowadays, and you know, their time is segmented and planned out. We just, you know, we were just outside playing in the dirt, what have you. So it was more freewheeling, and I think. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the running movement was a part of that, and I guess this was a little microcosm of that freewheelingness, was just, you know, go out there and do it.
Now, there were other kids in the race back then. Do you recall sort of competing against any of them or seeing any of them on the course during the race?
I don't. I do know that in the first New York City Marathon, I was the youngest finisher because I had a great honor of getting an award and actually getting on the stage with Bill Rogers, who was the winner. And, you know, I have a vague memory of my wobbly knees trying to make it up the steps to get that award. So there may have been other children, but I know I was the youngest finisher that year. Subsequent to that, maybe 77, 78, I think you had some real, like, you know, hot shots that came in. Mm-hmm. I know you interviewed Wesley Paul, and right. I know he was kind of a legendary runner. I was during those subsequent years. I was still signed up for the marathon, but I would say that I really didn't do very much training. Actually, in the years 78 to maybe 80 or 81 when I ran it, I pretty much didn't run the whole year and would run the week before it. And attempt to make it through. So it really was my time. I mean, you could see I was getting older. Until I put a little training in 82, I think my times were actually getting slower every year. So, you know, it was a great experience for the first 15 or 16 miles running on fumes. But I got to tell you, you know, running maybe 20 miles throughout the whole year and then running a marathon, I would not advocate that for anyone, much less a kid. But that's what I did.
Now, what are, you know, beyond not seeing the banana splits every 3 miles,
right.
what are some of the vivid memories or even the blurry memories at this stage that you have of running it as a kid, you know?
Well, I do have some, I remember going down Fourth Avenue, and I remember seeing the big clock that I believe is somewhere around, what is it, maybe 8 or 9 miles in Brooklyn. I have... vivid memories. I have a memory of going up those steps that they now are calling into question. I don't know if you know what I'm referring to, but there's been some debate whether those steps took place. I read a book by Bill Rogers, and he seems to remember going up those steps. But then I've heard people say that the steps never existed. So
right.
I remember going up those steps down paralleling the East River because we were not going up First Avenue.
Uh-huh.
I also remember just the physical devastation of New York City at that time, and I remember the foreboding that people had of going into the South Bronx in 1976, and the feeling that even though at that point you just went over the bridge and maybe went a quarter mile in, I remember there was, some thought like, street gangs might get you, or, you're actually going to there's going to be rubble or burnt out buildings you're going to have to run through, or, something like that. And then my only other vivid memory was maybe about mile 23. The crowds had been so supportive because I was not only 10, but I was very short at that time. I think I was about 4'1". And I remember just one kid jumped out of the crowd in Harlem and he said, "Yo, man, I hate to tell you, but the way you're looking, I don't think you're going to make it."
Oh.
And I just remember thinking to myself, whatever you do, I guess it's kind of an intuition thing. I've heard it subsequent, from many runners, that you just know that if you stop and walk, you're not going to make it.
Right.
And I remember I had been, at that stage at maybe mile 22 or 3 where I was going to walk. And as soon as that kid said it to me, I said, "I am not going to walk. I don't care how slow I have to go. I don't care what I'm going to do." And I just, put my head down, and it was just immense pain those last 3 or 4 miles. But, I made it, and, it was a trip. And those would probably be the vivid memories that I have of that marathon.
Do you remember crossing the finish line that first year?
I remember crossing the finish line, and I remember just thinking, that this entire day, not just the marathon, but the entire day had seemed like an eternity. And I remember just people holding me up. I think people were just shocked to see a kid, so... I mean, the predominant thing I think a kid will remember is the predominant thing anyone will remember is just utter exhaustion and kind of this, "Oh my God, how am I going to get home from here?" type of thing.
And I mean, and how did you get home? Was your mother there at the finish line, or?
Yeah, my mom was there, and somehow I lived again maybe a mile and a half from the finish line, so I, probably was hoisted or piggybacked. I don't quite remember. I do remember going to PS 84, which was my school, the next day, and they actually, put an announcement on the loudspeaker and said, "Brad finished the marathon." And I remember people coming up to me all day and saying, "Great, that's amazing, but what's a marathon?"
Wow. Thank you for sharing. Those are great memories. Now, in 1982, you said you put in a bit of training. Was breaking 3 a goal for you?
I think I didn't really know whether I was going to run a 2:45 or a 3:45, and I was training with the Central Park Track Club at the time. I don't know if I was officially on the club at that point, but I definitely had some speed in my legs, and I believe I'd maybe run a 4:40 mile or something like that. So on paper, I knew I was good for a sub-3, but, again, the marathon is such a humbling distance that you don't really know what you're going to get until you open the box, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that I specifically was training for a sub-3, but, I remember finishing and, being exhausted, but being happy with my time and feeling like I'd accomplished something and feeling like definitely like I'd gone under some type of a barrier, that being 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons I was looking forward to this interview from the very time we spoke in the corral there was your answer to my question when I asked you that morning. I saw you in the corral ready to go again. I said, "Oh, so you didn't have any burnout or anything?" But looking at your race results and from your answer that morning, you said, in fact, you did burn out.
Yeah. I mean, well, I burnt out twice. If you're referring to my burning out as a kid or burning out, as an adult, I did a little of both.
In our interview with Wesley, I was just surprised at sort of how sane and rational he seemed.
Right.
When we hear about kids who run marathons at very early ages, I mean, it's just hard to fit that in my head. And then
right,
I would think,
right.
Well, either this person's going to be a superstar or this person's going to hate running.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what happened? Clearly, you ran fantastically this last year. What happened in the years between being a child runner and coming back and being a fantastic masters runner?
Well, I mean, I think you're definitely nailed it when you said you're either become a star or you hate it. And as you know, as a kid, I definitely didn't love it after those couple of marathons. I think, you know, perhaps if I had been running the track or running, you know, 5Ks or something, but I really pretty much, you know, as I said, you know, at age, you know, from age maybe 12 to 14, I was doing the marathon, but I wasn't doing any training for it. It just became kind of a strange ritual that I did it every year and really didn't train for it. But, you know, I think you can definitely even, you know, you always imagine you've got to be an old man to have misty memories. And I think the reality is that by the time I was 15 and 16, I already had some misty memories of how I'd been a pretty good runner when I was about 10 and how I'd been a pretty crappy runner when I was maybe, you know, 12 and 13. And I at age 15 or maybe 16, you know, I started again. And then when I started, I was doing it more in my own terms. And, you know, luckily I hooked up with the great former coach who's a mentor to Tony, I know, in many ways, George Wisniewski of the Central Park Track Club, the former coach. And, you know, at that point, I kind of rejuvenated my running. And, you know, I was able to, you know, run that sub 250. But, you know, even more importantly, you know, within a year of that, I'd run like a sub 420 mile in high school. And you know, I was, you know, not an earth-shattering runner, but I was good enough to get a scholarship to college. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, running definitely did play an important role in my youth. I just had a very young youth, and then I had a little break, and then I had a youth, you could say, you know, from age 16 to maybe age 24, 25, when I flung my spikes away again and decided I didn't have any interest and didn't pick them up again for another 22 years, I believe.
And in that time, what filled the void for you hobby-wise? Like, was there something that you put as much effort into, or...
Drinking, partying, going out. You know, I think maybe some of the things that I didn't do in high school, I had a little deferred transfer to later in life. You know, I mean, I did other things. You know, I played guitar, and obviously, you know, I was working, and of course, you know, I got married, and in the later part of that stage, you know, had a child. So there were definitely, you know, I was pretty busy doing a lot of things. But you know, athletics, I you know, would occasionally go to the gym. I would do some weightlifting, but running was very far removed from my mind. In fact, even things like the Olympics, I wouldn't really show any interest even in watching it. It's kind of like I've punished myself enough in my day, and I don't want to watch people punish themselves. But you know, just like I said, you can have misty memories of being 10 when you're 16. You can have misty memories of being 20 when you're 45. And you know, I think at that age, maybe I was 46. I took a look and I said, you know, I'm 210 pounds here, and yeah, I can bench press my weight, but you know, what am I doing to my heart? What am I doing to my arteries? And you know, what, you know, I guess I rediscovered that I like to be outside, and I like to, you know, get with a group of guys, and I you know, just like to, you know, do this kind of, you know, it's a very group oriented thing in one respect, but it's a very, you know. You know, as any long distance runner knows, you know, I guess it was that book, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner.
Yeah.
And you know, it's not just loneliness; it's time to yourself, and it's clearing your head, and it's being able to sort your thoughts. And you know, I think as you get older, you kind of need that time away from family or, you know, your career.
Yeah.
And so I reestablished that, and you know, it's you know, been, apart from a lot of injuries, it's been really great the last few years. You know, running. just the running aspect, whether he even took out the competitive aspect, just been, you know, very good, you know, mentally to have that.
Was it tough getting started again, or no? Were you questioning whether you'd be able to, you know, run?
Yeah, I definitely questioned, because my intention was not to come back and join the club and run races. It was really just, you know, I should be getting my weight down a little bit. I shouldn't be, you know, 210 pounds here. And I'm still got injuries. You know, I've had injuries straight through. But my first, let's say, 2 years from like maybe 46 to 48, I would say I really couldn't get in any speed work, because I was just, you know, went from my calf to my Achilles to my groin to my calf to my back. And so it kind of, you know, I wasn't really able to rush back and do it, you know, jump in head first, so to speak. But, you know, I guess what that maybe enabled me to do was to, well, forced me to do was to come back slowly. And I think the positive aspect to that, you know, is if you've run some, you know, obviously not, you know, world class or national class times, but some decent times in your youth, and you're now, you know, 46, 47 years old, you know, if you come back with your guns blazing, I think a lot of people think they're going to be slower, but they're just going to be a slower version of themselves. And, you know, that's a rude awakening, because what really you're going to find is that you're a completely different person. And I think what was helpful to me was being injured and having to come back slow. I really didn't have any misconceptions that I could be Superman. Huh. And I was able to, you know, be happy with being a different version of myself. And, you know, and you know, then at that point, you know, once I started racing, being able to say, oh, there's this great thing I didn't even know about called age adjusted, and be able to go and say, okay, you know, I might, you know, be pretty slow compared to a lot of people in these races, but, you know, I'm doing okay as an old guy, and, you know, feel good about myself.
Well, you're doing okay as a young guy too. I mean, by any standards, a 4:55 mile that you did at Fifth Avenue Mile this year is faster than most.
Yep. Well,
so it seems like, you know, you're really hitting your stride competitively recently. And when you lined up for the New York City Marathon this year, you know, we were talking, you asked me what I was aiming for, and I said, well, right, try to break three, and you said, oh, the same. So you ended up running 2:50. Was that much better than you had expected, or were you just sandbagging a little in the corral?
I was probably sandbagging a little in the corral, to be honest.
Made
but,
me feel better.
By the same token, you know, I had taken 2 weeks off completely from running due to some pretty bad plantar fasciitis, which unfortunately is, you know, it's still got me hobbling right now. And so the reality is I thought my training was in probably something where I could have gotten maybe into the mid to high 240s, but with missing 2 weeks right prior to it and only running for, you know, how do you taper from nothing, you know, was really basically what it comes to. So basically doing nothing for 2 weeks, I wasn't sure, you know, how, you know, if I'd be really fresh or really rusty. And I guess it was a little bit of both. But, you know, it was definitely an experience. And I definitely went out a little bit too quick. I went out in 1:22. And, you know, it was fun, but it wasn't so much fun those last 6 miles. Let me put it that way.
What surprised you most this time around?
Well, I think what surprised me, you know, not having done this since the early 80s, I mean, so many things were similar. I mean, the crowds were the same. The energy was the same. I guess I could say what surprised me was really the extent to the fact that you can put in some long runs and you can put in some speed work and you think you've touched on all your systems, but until you actually do that event, the marathon, you're not going to know what toll it's really going to take on you. And, you know, I think that was what really surprised me. I thought I know what the marathon's going to hand to me, and I know how I'm going to handle it. And the reality is that when the piano came on my back, I mean, it was just, you know, it was like that kid up in Harlem again. You know, I had to play that voice in my head just to not start walking. You know, that voice saying, "Man, you ain't gonna make it. You don't look so good." And you know, so it was there. You know, if I really think back to how I felt, you know, 40 years ago when I ran it, there were no surprises. It was the same thing. But I guess, you know, you don't have that. You only remember the good things, and until you get out there and you run the race again, you don't remember just the pure, you know, the almost primal fear that can take over. You know, just like, oh my God, this is, you know, this is not normal. I've got 5 miles to go, and yeah. You know, and I mean, your body is telling me, you know, is saying to you, you know, pull over, don't go, and you know, right. You know, your pride is saying, you know, saying, you know, you got to make it. So.
Who was it? I think maybe Frank Shorter, who said you need to forget the last marathon before you line up for the next one.
Right. I think Frank Shorter also, I read a quote where he said the marathon is divided into two halves, and the second half doesn't begin till after 20 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, he definitely knew a thing or two, you know?
Yeah, no doubt. Now, I just getting into your one more question about your race this year. You know, I know your splits were about 5 minutes off the second half.
Right.
For the first half, but still, I imagine that the average split is far more of a positive split than that. So I got a two-part question. Basically, what did keep you going, and were you passing a lot of people towards the end?
No. At the end, I was definitely not passing people, but... I mean, I think a lot of, you know, I was with a crowd of people that looked like they were all dying, and I think we were all just, you know, kind of strung out and hanging on at that point, and again, you know, the reality is, I had a situation where because I had to take a couple of weeks off immediately prior to it, I think my lungs were good, but it was actually somewhere about mile 7 or mile 8, you know, which is pretty early in the marathon, that my thighs began to cramp and began to really fall apart on me. So, you know, my big problem in that race was just, you know, what's supposed to happen really late in the race. It did happen, but it started a lot earlier than you would anticipate. I started to hit the wall about mile 8 or 9. You know, if you know, and really just had to run, you know, for 15 or 16 miles with my legs really giving in on me. So it was a gut check. I mean, it really was a situation where I said, you know, my wife and my daughter and a couple of friends are going to be out here on the course. And, you know, I'm just, you know, unless I actually cramp up and have a situation where I'm, you know, falling down, I said, I'm going to have to make it across that line, you know, one way or the other. So
that's great. Well, fantastic performance.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Bren.
It's really fantastic.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to put gloom and doom on it, cause I know the time, you know, 250 was, you know, is not a bad time. I'm just saying that I definitely, you know, I didn't run 20 miles, you know, feeling free as a bird and then die. I ran the last 15 miles, you know, really just in a lot of pain.
So two more general questions. So first, we'll be talking to Tony, and including that talk in our episode here. What's your first memory, or when did you meet our coach Tony Ruiz?
Well, I met Tony. I'm going to guess it was probably 1981. I may have seen him or been around him in some capacity, but I don't believe I met Tony until 81. And we were, you know, I think he's about 4 or maybe 5 years older than me. So, you know, he was still definitely tearing it up, you know, at that age, and was definitely a bit quicker than I was. But, Tony is just always been, you know, when people ask me about Tony, you know, and, you know, they call him, you know, Coach Tony, you know, he's always had he has now exactly what he had back then, which is not only does he have the technical skills to be a coach, you know, the knowledge, which of course you have to have some intuition and everything to put these workouts together. But, you know, the reality is that, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. in terms of workouts. But, you know, I think what Tony has is he has an uncanny ability to relate to people and an uncanny ability to make anyone, you know, young, old, slow, fast, to just make them feel special. And I think that's, you know, why, you know, from the top down, you know, the Central Park Track Club is such a great place. Now, in terms of the memories that I have of Tony, I mean, we ran a lot of those Tuesday, Thursdays together. And I just remember many Thursdays coming down, you know, finishing whatever the workouts were, you know, towards the statue, you know, coming down with a half mile to go. And it was, you know, it was always Tony time, because Tony had an extra gear that he could turn on me. In fact, I have my high school training log, and I think I mentioned this to Tony a few months ago. And I said, Tony, I found my training log. We had a club championship up at City College. I think it was 1983 or 1984. And we would run, I think it was 12 or 16 laps to the mile. And we had the club championship. And I was actually, you know, I think I was, you know, 17 still, but I was leading that mile with one lap to go. And I remember in my log, which again, I just pulled out and I read it just, you know, maybe 3 months ago. And it said, was leading the mile, with 200 to go, ahead of Tony and a few other people. And I just, and my final line in there was, it didn't end well. And then I have Tony's time written, then I have my time written. And I think Tony's time is about 6 seconds quicker than mine. And, you know, that happened over the last 200 to 300 yards. So, yeah. You know, Tony, Tony's the type of guy that people would run through a wall for, and he's a very consistent person, and he's a person that I think Tony would probably say this, you know, in his interview, but he's a person I think that was very lucky in a sense, because he was, you know, we were coached by an incredible coach who not only had these same things that Tony has, which is, you know, knowing how to put together a workout and understanding the fundamentals of building great runners, but also, you know, had that ability to relate to people and the ability to, as I said, to make the young, the old, the slow, the fast, and, you know, make, you know, really, you know, running a team of guys. I don't know how many people are on the club now, you know, a couple hundred, but, you know everybody's name and you know, cheer for everybody. You know, Tony sounds like a bullhorn, you know, when he's in Central Park, you know, in some of those races. And you know, we had a great coach, you know, George Wisniewski was his name. And I think Tony probably invented a few things himself and modified a few things himself. And you know, it's just I'm very lucky to have met both of them, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I like how Tony, he looks you in the eye when he talks to you. You get a sense that he cares for the whole person, not just the runner.
Yep, and it's amazing because, again, I don't have any idea how many people are in the club, but, you know, he certainly knows everyone by name, and, you know, he like I said, the man is a human bullhorn, you know, and I don't know, I've seen him appear 3 or 4 times in a 10K race in Central Park. I don't know if he's on a bicycle or, you know, what he's doing. But,
you know, he gets around. You know, the secret shortcuts to get.
I guess he's, you know, he's been, you know, using that park in some capacity for so long that, you know, that, but, you know, so again, you know, I know Tony way back, and, you know, there's some stories, you know, I'd share if we had more time, and some stories I wouldn't share if we had, but you know, what can I say? The man is truly amazing.
He is. Okay. Last question. We asked this of all our guests, and we've gotten some great answers from some very fast runners. So, The name of our website's Cloud 259, because when we started it, Greg and I were both 3:08 marathoners looking to break 3, and we've gotten under there once or twice. But we were looking for advice from all of our guests, and not just on breaking three, which was our initial goal, but basically in setting a PR in the marathon. For all our listeners, and they range from people who could probably break 2:20 to those who are looking to break 5 hours, what's your best piece of advice? It could be either training advice or race day advice.
Well, I think race day advice would be very simple, which would be apart from, you know, very obvious things, which is, you know, get your fluid and you know, do things, you know, don't wait till you need a drink. And you know, don't do what I did in New York, which is, you know, go out too hard, you know, have a plan. But, apart from those race day things, I would say the most important thing, you know, for the marathon is in a word, it's consistency. And, you know, in terms of consistency, you know, it means doing these fundamental things that you need to, you know, to get to your goal. And you know, I believe that, you know, the kind of Central Park formula, which is the Tuesday, Thursday mm-hmm. long run, mm-hmm. you know, you want to think there's a secret beyond that. But, you know, there really is no secret between, you know, going out there and, you know, getting out there and doing tempo run, going out there and doing some type of a long run, and really getting the speed work, right? But, you know, but with that said, you know, I think, you know, getting back to the idea of consistency, you know, would be that, you know, certainly I'm injured, you know, a lot of the time, and I think some people are just, you know, disposed to it. But, you know, the most important things are just don't get injured and don't get sick. Because if you don't get injured and you don't get sick, and you're able to consistently put in the work, you know, you're going to see the results. You're going to see the results for you. And you know, you may have set an arbitrary goal. You may be running 3:20 and say, I want to break 2:40. Mm-hmm. It might be that that's not in the cards for you. But
right.
you know, whatever is in the cards for you and is within your potential, if you can find a way to be consistent, you know, then you can get to where you hopefully, you know, want to go, or someplace that you can be happy. And I think I would also say that as you get older, you know, being in my 50s now, is, you know, very important, and a snippet of advice would be that when you're young, you could, you know, I think a lot of young people can kind of train through injuries, and you can wait till you can give your injury a real shot at not developing, and you can continue to run and run through injuries and, you know, maybe fake it through, and it can be actually a wise choice at sometimes. I think now what I realize is you have to treat twinges, and I don't know if twinges is a word. I think it's a word.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to anything that's suspicious should really warrant 2 or 3 days on your stationary bike, on the elliptical, in the swimming pool, you know, whatever your alternate means of keeping your aerobic base up. Because what I've found out the hard way is that injury that you could have run through when you were 20 is actually going to run through you when you're 45 or 50. I think we're, a lot of us fall prey to it, but we're so frightened of losing, you know, losing the fitness that we put in when we're training for the marathon, that we're incapable of taking 4 or 5 days off, and that 4 or 5 days that you could have taken, you know, is going to turn into 4 or 5 weeks, or if you're really unlucky, you know, 4 or 5 months. So that, you know, I guess my, you know, in terms of, you know, your secrets for the marathon would be, A, there's no secret. You've got to get in your long run. You've got to get in your speed work, and you've got to get in your tempo run. Mm-hmm. And then B, you've got to be consistent. And when you get older, being consistent doesn't mean just being consistently running. It means consistently listening to your body and consistently having the guts actually to back off. Because, you know, we're so competitive that we think that it takes guts to run through an injury. But I think the mm-hmm. reality is, in a sense, it actually takes guts to not run through the injury.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's just something you have to learn the hard way. But, you know, I think a lot of marathon training has probably been dashed because people are doing great, and they're you know, their mileage is up and they're doing what they should be doing, and they feel something that shouldn't be there. And instead of, you know, accepting the fact that 4 or 5 days isn't going to sink your ship, you know, you try to train through it, and 4 or 5 days becomes 4 or 5 weeks. And the next thing you know, you're either not lining up or you're lining up on in the marathon, and your training isn't, you know, where it should have or could have been.
Well, Brad, you've been really generous with your time, and you've dispensed a whole lot of wisdom and some great memories for us.
Thank you, Brad,
so much for joining us on the show. And I'm going to try and get in shape so I can keep up with you, perhaps on some training runs, if not races.
No, it'd be wonderful, and it was, you know, it was wonderful. Actually, I hadn't thought of some of those memories actually, you know, in 40 years, or you know, definitely since I spoke with you, you know, in the area before the marathon. So you definitely. You know, it was definitely a trip. What can I say? And you know, I think it's wonderful that you've got this podcast, and I think it's wonderful that I'm gonna have 51 episodes to listen to, because you know, now that I'm on the bike with this darn plantar fasciitis, I have a lot of, you know, I have a lot of time to listen to podcasts.
Okay, super. Thanks, Brad. We'll see you out at the park.
Okay, wonderful.
Okay, bye now.
Bye bye.
I am really honored to have on the show my coach at the Central Park Track Club, Tony Ruiz. Tony is the head road coach for CPTC. He has been a coach in one form or another for the club for over a quarter century now, over 25 years. One thing I'll say about Tony is neither snow nor rain nor gloom of night is going to keep him from the Daniel Webster statue on Thursday night for the road workouts, and at Tuesday for the track workouts, wherever they may be on the East River or up at the Armory. Tony, before he was a coach, had a stellar career as a mid-distance runner. First, in the late 70s, he burned up the track at the Armory for Westinghouse High School. It was a wood track back then. In 1980, he was an alternate on the Puerto Rican Olympic team in the 800 meters and in the mile. In 1982, he started ripping it up for Central Park Track Club. And as an athlete, he's on several of the top 10 lists all time. As a coach, he's coached national champions, top 10 American finishers in the New York City Marathon. But most importantly for me is hundreds of New York City athletes who've run personal bests. I'd say probably thousands at this point who've run personal bests have trained with Tony, certainly myself among them. I'd say, you know, more than any of that, Tony's a straight shooter. He loves track. He is really highly beloved on the team, and he's got lots of stories to tell. So, Tony Ruiz, welcome to Cloud 259, and we're excited to hear some of these stories.
Well, thank you for having me, Brendan. Thank you for the wonderful introduction there.
Tony, so we want to complete this series of runners talking about running the New York City Marathon when they were ridiculously young. Now, I've just heard snippets of your story, but I do understand that you did race it once. Can you tell us a bit about that experience?
Well, my experience with the first New York City Marathon that they ran through the five boroughs of New York, which was in 1976, and you know, of course, you know that Fred LeBeau orchestrated that whole thing, and the reason I believe that they put it through the five boroughs was because it was the bicentennial celebration, so they wanted to do something special, you know, in mm-hmm. addition to just, you know, bringing running and the marathon into more focus and having it, you know, having people recognize that running, you know, was a wonderful sport, and bringing it into all the communities, you know, the five boroughs. But so at that time, I was in high school. I was in my sophomore year, and I had started to really run some, you know, fast times. The day before the marathon, I ran cross-country meet. When I ran my personal record at that time, you know, the sophomore of 13:30 at Van Cortlandt Park. And Sunday, one of my teammates and I were going to take a long run, and we had Brooklyn Champs coming up the following week. Mm-hmm. And we said, okay, well, you know, we'll do a long run. And something he heard through somebody told him that they were doing this race through the five boroughs. And we just, he said, really? When is that? Tomorrow morning. And we said, oh, wow. Well, what, you want to do part of the race and, you know, as part of the workout? And we said, okay, let's get up and, you know, go to the start line. So we wound up, we got up. I mean, you have to imagine this whole thing now with, you know, you having to go through what you have to go through right. now just to get to the marathon.
Right.
So we were able to get up that morning, took the train, got into Staten Island, went over to the bridge, and just went right to the line. And because I was in high school, you know, I was running in a PSAL, Public School mm-hmm. Athletic League. We were not allowed to enter officially because, you know, you couldn't. We weren't planning to race anyway. You know, we were supposed to stop. That was the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get to the starting line. The gun goes off. I think there were maybe a little over 1,000 runners the first year. And we take off over the bridge, and we get into Brooklyn, you know, 8-9 miles into the race. Next thing you know, we're in the Queensboro Bridge, and we hit First Avenue. And that was really the most we were supposed to run, you know, 13 mm-hmm. to 15 miles. And we were supposed to stop right there. Of course, at that point, I mistake that. When we came off 59th Street, there was no First Avenue. Okay, what we had to do back in those days was, well, that year, I think it was probably the only year they did it, was we ran over on the East River.
Right.
Along the East River. And then you had to cross back over to First Avenue at some point. I don't know exactly where it was, maybe 18-mile mark. We did run on First Avenue later on, but not like the First Avenue, how they go right from 59th Street.
Right. Now, Brad Kelly remembers running up a staircase, and there's some controversy over whether there was or was not a staircase run. Do you remember running up a staircase, or was it a ramp, as Bill Rogers suggests?
I do remember staircases. And, yeah. You know, the funny thing is with that is that, yeah. You know, as a young kid, I used to dream a lot with running, right?
Uh-huh.
So for many, many years after that, I swore in my head that I ran up these stairs, and but I would never tell anyone that because I said that just sounds crazy. Like no one's going to believe me. So a few years ago, you know, was talking to George Hirsch
uh-huh.
at the team benefit dinner, and so I just you know approached the subject and hey George, do you remember 1976? Because I was sure he ran. He says yeah, the first marathon. And we just started chatting, and I, you know, I just started picking his brain. And then he says, oh, yeah, you know, the craziest thing was when we had to go up the stairs. Do you remember that?
Uh-huh.
And I said, yes, I do. I said, but I didn't, I said, I would never tell anybody because I said I wasn't 100% sure that it was a dream or that I actually did it. But I do remember that we went up these stairs. And
I think they had
and then
a ramp
after
for
that,
Rogers and stairs for everybody else.
Yeah. I mean, I do remember, but there was also the ramp. We had to go up a ramp on the heliport. You know, like there was a heliport ramp at some point there, maybe in the 50s or the 60s, when you first get onto the East River. So I remember doing the ramp there, but then to get over from the East River, we had to do stairs. There are no ramps. If you look at the East River, even back then, there wasn't a ramp that went from one side to the other. There's always been stairs there.
So at this point of the race, you'd done what you had set out to do, and then what was the thinking, or were you feeling pretty good? Like,
oh yeah, no, I mean at that point, me and my buddy were basically racing. You know, once we got to about, you know, once we got to about 20 miles. We basically had our race face on, you know.
Uh-huh. And this is a day after you ran, and it was 13:30 in a cross country. Do you know what the distance was of that race?
It's a 2.5. It's the high school
uh-huh.
course
yeah.
at Van Cortlandt.
Yeah.
I think that year, at that time, I think it was the second fastest time for a sophomore that year.
So a day after burning up, this is no tapering advice for people, a day after burning up a 2.5 mile, incredibly difficult course in 1330, you're feeling good at 20 miles and you're competing with your buddy. So take us through the last 6 miles.
Well, what happened was we got over to Marcus Garvey, and he looks at me and he goes, "Tony, I think my leg is broken." I looked at him and I said, "Louis, are you kidding me?" And he goes, No, I think my leg's broken." So we stopped, you know, I stopped, I stretched him out, and I said, "Are you okay?" And, you know, I kind of touched his legs, he seemed fine. Apparently he was just cramping up and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then next thing you know, well, you know, maybe a couple of minutes later, we're back to heading out to Central Park, you know, to finish up. So we take off, and so here I am being a nice guy, you know, I'm stretching him out, making sure that we get through this thing, you know. And the next thing you know, we get into Central Park. We had to go up 1/100 second, at, you know, in those years you'd go into the park through 1/100 second entrance.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And so we're there and at that point now the race is on, and I'm like looking at this guy and I'm like, "Dude, your leg was broken a minute ago. Now you're trying to race me, you know?" So, you know, at that point we get over to, 59th Street. We come up the little hill. I got knees up to my chest. You know, I was young. I actually had a kick back then. So I still got a little something, you know. Yeah, I got some muscle memory, you know, a little. But so we get about 100 meters from the start line, and the guy from the Roadrunners notices that we don't have numbers on, you know.
Right.
And we got this duel going on, and he just, like, he yokes us, you know. He just, like, puts his arm out. And he arm bars us, and we go down to the ground, you know. So we just laying on the side of, you know, about 100 meters from the finish line, you know, there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the funniest part of the story for me, it's something that I will never forget, is that as we're laying there, the coach from Brooklyn Tech, you know, Westinghouse and Brooklyn Tech were essentially 1 and 2 in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Sophomore, junior, and senior year, we were, you know, so we were big rivals. And the coach from Brooklyn Tech rarely said a word to me ever. And he just happens to be at the spot that where we finish, and he looks down at me, and he has this big grin. His name is Ed Zarwin,
mm-hmm.
Great coach. George Wisniewski, who was the coach of our, you know, my mentor, he was the coach mm-hmm. of Central Park. Zarwin was his mentor, and, you know, at Brooklyn Tech in the 60s. Ed Zarwin's been coached for years, and he's still 90 years old, still just recently retired from Hunter. But he looked at me, and he gave me this grin, and he said, "I'll see you next week at Brooklyn." And I guess, you know, in retrospect, I realized that he just basically said, "You just gave us the Brooklyn champs," you know?
Right.
And of course, he was right. I mean, I ran well the... You know, I actually had a dual meet two days later, which I had to run because I didn't want the coach to know that we did the whole marathon.
Yeah.
So I had to wind up doing the dual meet 2 days later, and then the following Saturday was Brooklyn Champs. And,
wow.
You know, we still took second as a team, but we obviously, we gave him that title that year.
Now, so you're 100 meters from the finish, and you're on the ground. Were you able to get up at some point and finish it?
No, we could barely move at that point. You know, we were kicking. I mean, we were literally just like spent. You know,
right?
And
right.
I mean, I would have run like 2:48. The clock said 2:48. When you know, uh-huh. at the time that we went down,
mm-hmm.
and we had watches on, and I was even interviewed afterwards. Some local reporter, and I could never find that piece, you know. It was in the Bay News in Brighton Beach. And he interviewed me about the race and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I'd love to be able to get that piece, but, that was my experience with the first New York City Marathon.
Wow.
You know?
And you never came back to the marathon, is that right?
I ran the marathon two times and both unofficially. And the reason, I mean, if you know my background a little bit, you know that I was always, you know, I ran through high school and college.
Yeah.
And because of that, I was always, you know, particularly when I went to college, you know, you're on scholarship, so they obviously keep an eye on you. And, you know, at that time, marathon racing, it's not like it is now, you know, like it was something that only, you know, very few people did. They didn't like young people really doing it. And to be quite honest, it wasn't really that big of a deal, you know, like track was much bigger in the U.S. at that time, you know. You know, the running boom really didn't come till later in the 80s. So most of my career, I did a lot of long races as a junior, you know, like 30Ks. During the summer months when I was off from school, I'd run like, you know, half marathons, 30Ks. But the marathon always came in November, you know, October, November. And during that time, I would always be running track, you know, for either my high school or college or even with Central Park when I came, I joined Central Park. So, you know, I was pretty good at all the other distances. So my coach forbid me, even though I would train with guys like John Kenny, Mike Trunkus, Bob Meehan, Fred Colte. These are guys from Central Park who were running in the 220s, you know, the mid, and even George Wisniewski, who was the coach. You know, I would go out with them in the mountains and run 20 miles and be right there with them. But he, you know, he just forbid me to run marathons because I have a bad knee. My right knee would always buckle on me when I would run on roads. So I never got a shot to do it. But I did do it in after the Olympics were canceled in 1980.
Uh-huh.
I did basically the same thing. I just got up the morning. I quit running for a year after the disappointment of the 1980 Olympic boycott.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't run for a year, and I started kind of doing like, you know, I gained some pounds, and it was the only time in my life where I just totally stopped running for like for a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1981, I just got up the morning of the race, which is, it's an interesting story because that's actually how I got recruited by Central Park. And that morning, same kind of thing. Only thing, I just did it on my own. I just got up and I just said, you know, I'm just going to go run with the guys. I hadn't seen some of my teammates in a long time.
Mm.
And I said, I'm just going to go out and run the marathon for practice or run as much as I could.
Uh-huh.
And That time, it was the regular course through First Avenue. It was 1981. And I just, same thing. You know, you could just walk right up to the race and, you know, like, just start right there. You didn't have to enter or, you know, go through all kinds of changes to get to the start line at that point. And so that year, I got to First Avenue. I was running at a pretty good pace. I ran into one of my teammates, Ramelo Delaval, he changed his name, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I ran pretty much the whole race together, and he wound up leaving me with about a mile and a half to go. He wound up running 2:32,
wow.
And I would have probably run about 2:34 that day,
wow.
You know. But
wow.
Yeah, that day they didn't clothesline me because I knew that I didn't have a number, so I just stepped out.
So you would have run about a 2:34 just coming back off of a year off of running. I mean, you know, I thought you were a speed guy, Tony. You know, you don't really preach the marathon so much, but it sounds like you had some distance chops.
Oh, no, I mean, you got to remember, as a kid, you know, in high school, like I said, during the summers, I would always run, like, high volume, you
mm-hmm.
know, to get in shape.
Mm-hmm.
So from the time I was 15, 16 years old, I always ran, like, long races, you know. In fact, we won a few of the, what they were called, AAUs, like these AAU big championships that they had. And we won, like, the 30K, and, you know, so I had a long history of distance running. But the problem, like I said, I could never really totally focus on distance running because I was pretty fast at 800. And so once I got finished cross country, I would go right into 800 and 1500 training.
Right.
I'd even race 400 sometimes on relays. So,
Right. Now, in those, we'll get to your track, some of your track races in a minute, but I just want to finish up on the marathon. In your races, do you remember sort of the agony of the last 6 miles, or did you never really hit a wall in the marathons that you ran?
No, I actually didn't because like I said, I just basically ran those races. The two times that I ran the marathon, I basically just got up and just decided to go running. You know, mm-hmm. It was almost like the Forrest Gump kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I just feel like going to run. And but I mean, I had a lot of history. You know, I mean, I trained for years. It wasn't like I just got up and ran a 2:34.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I had started running, I think, that day, that year, in around the summer. So it might have been like August after taking off like a year. And so I had trained about August, September, and October. So I had a little bit of training. You know, back then, you know, when you're young, you 2 or 3 weeks you're in shape, you know?
Yeah.
And so I had history already, so I made, you know, my adaptation, my aerobic adaptation within a month, I was in good shape, but I just hadn't raced and I never really trained to run the marathon at an optimal level. Although, you know, I talked to a lot of the old Central Park guys, like all those guys that were running 2:20s, and mm-hmm. they would always tell me that I probably would have been able to beat them or at least run close to them, you know. But mm-hmm. I just never really did get to the point where I said, you know, I'm just going to run a marathon, because I knew that my knee. One, you know, I had a couple of incidents where I would get like this knee pain, and my knee would literally buckle, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just like fall to the ground, and that happened to me in a couple of those like long races, half marathon. It would always happen during road races, long road races. So, you know, my coach just forbid me. He said, "Listen, you know, you're a lifer, and I know you love running, and if you stay off the road, you know, off long road races, you'll probably make 50 years old." At the time, I thought 50 was incredibly old. You know, I was like, I
now,
just hope to be alive.
Do you thank
your
coach for that advice now? Or are you glad that you stayed off?
Oh, he was a genius, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, George Wisniewski, you know, is probably the smartest guy I know in terms of just recognizing runners and their abilities. I mean, he could just uh-huh. see things. You know, he would just look at a runner sometimes and just go like, "You see that guy striding, you know, he should stay with short stuff, or, you know, he's got too much torque. He's going to wind up messing up his hip." Like, uh-huh. he would just make these comments. And so a lot of my, a lot of the stuff that I get in terms of coaching marathon runners is just from being with him, you know, uh-huh. most of his 17 years, 18 years as the coach of the team. And you know, I train with a lot of the guys, but I would sit down and talk to him about, you know, training philosophy and just, you know, running types. And he just, you know, he told me, "Listen, you can have a long career, but you can't do the pounding on the roads, in terms of racing." And I took his advice, and it was the best advice I could have ever taken, because, you know, I'm 55 and I'm still, you know, I still get around a track a few times, you know, whenever I get the desire to do so. But, yeah, I am grateful that I didn't go that route. You know, I'm sure I wouldn't have made it, you know, without a major injury.
So you had a basically a 2:48 and a 2:34, and what would the other marathon? What would your time have been in the other one that you finished or that you ran unofficially?
It was just those two.
Just those two. Okay, got it.
Yeah, so yeah. That was 1981. That was basically the last time that I ran for 26 miles, you know?
Got it.
Yeah.
Let's flip to the coaching side just for a minute before we get back to some of your races as an athlete. So as one of your Central Park Track Club runners, all I can say is that, you know, in the workouts, we try to pace it well. And when you come into view, we all try to straighten up a bit and look our best and you know, put on a mm-hmm. brave face. Now, what is the workout like from your point of view as a coach? When you're watching your athletes train for the marathon, on a Thursday night, you're running around the park. What are you looking for, and what are you seeing as a coach?
Well, I generally, what I look out for, I try to pick up tendencies with certain runners. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very difficult to kind of, you know, it's not like I'm on a bicycle, like, you know, coaching a runner one-on-one. you know, where you can actually see everything that they're doing. Because it's such big groups, I often, when I go out, as you know, I will often see you guys three or four times during a particular workout.
Right.
And then so I'll look, and two things I look for. One is I look to see who's out ahead at the beginning, you know, who has a tendency to go out really hard, whether they can hold it, or are they constantly dying? Do they always go out hard and then die at the end? So I look sort of for like those extremes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that I look for, because I usually can make quick corrections on that kind of thing. The other thing I look for generally, especially like in the, like when I give you guys, say, the 2 4-mile loops, that 8-mile workout. So I you know, I'm just looking to see how people, if they're focused, how is the form, you know, are they running extremely tight mm-hmm. during the second phase of that workout? So, and generally speaking, I mean, and also sometimes I'll give that workout twice, in a cycle, and I try to make determinations on, more on the second one, because we often make mistakes the first time around anyway. Even veterans, you know, it takes you, sometimes it'll take a few workouts before you kind of get into the right rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, once we make the correction, then we have the second one, then I'll see if the person is making the proper adjustment, both in terms of their approach and also their form, you know, how they're, you know, whether their stride is proper, whether they're opening up on downhills, you know. So those are a few of the things that I look for, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It amazes me.
And then, of course, you know, after, you know, we're going to talk, and generally I can, you know, make assessments after the workout to see whether they did, in fact, carry out the game plan or not, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to your, you know, we touched on in the open, your success in high school, and all being an alternate on the Olympic team, your success with the track club. You've also had a lot of success in cross country. Could you, first off, about the Puerto Rican Olympic alternate team, I hadn't heard that you were on that. What was that experience? I know that the Moscow, you know, the U.S. didn't send a team to Moscow. I thought that Puerto Rico may have sent some that ran under the Olympic banner or something. What was your experience with that?
Yeah, I think that year, actually, Puerto Rico may have sent a boxer or two, is what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't send any track athletes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know why that happened, you know. I just remember that the last race that I ran there, in college, because I wound up at the University of Puerto Rico in Bayamón,
mm-hmm.
right after Westinghouse High School. And, you know, they recruited me at Penn Relays when I ran 304.2 for the distance medley.
Mm-hmm.
They saw me there, and the coach said, you know, that's one of the fastest times ever run. You go to Puerto Rico, you're probably going to be the junior champion, which I was at 800 meters, and, you know, you might have a shot to make the Olympic team. So, and that was always sort of like my goal as a kid growing up, you know, and that was the vision that I had for myself and the goals that I had set for myself. So when I got there, I obviously, you know, started to make a name for myself and won juniors with a 154. And then as the season progressed, I was just getting stronger and stronger. I really got fast. My 400 time went down. And so then at the trials, you know, I got fourth. And only one guy had qualified in the 800.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he made the B standard, the first place guy. So the way it works is, you know, you have to, you know, either make the standard, or in some cases, most of the small islands generally only take one person, you know. But I think that they may have taken me just because to give me the experience.
Right.
You know, so I was still off, you know, from the at the time I think it was 148 was the B standard or something like that. And I had just run 151. But the thing that my coach told me right after the race, he said, you led for 750 meters. Like, I was in the lead. And then the guy that beat me, a guy named Victor Ramos, he passed me literally with 50 meters to go, and he ran 147. So in the last 50 meters, I lost 4 seconds. You know? So my coach, I mean, I was just, I had the bear on my back, you know, for the fat last 50 meters. Yeah. And but my coach was really happy, he was proud, and he said, hey, listen, you know, if you run your race instead of just trying to beat him, you can run under 150. That was what he felt. Uh-huh. And, you know, who knows? You know, there was still a couple of weeks to go before the last. You know, I think we had about 2 weeks. There's like a certain date by which you have to have the qualifying standard for, you know. And so I was going to give it a couple of shots. And then the day after the race was when they announced that the United States was going to boycott the Olympics and that Puerto Rico could not take a team because, you know, we're part of the United States. So I heard the news and I bolted right back to New York. And of course it was quite devastating, you know. And then, you know, I literally didn't run for a year after that. Came to New York and went to work. And the next time I ran was that day in 1981 where I told you I ran the marathon. And it was, and the great story about this is that that day when I'm running the marathon, this was the one I ran at 2:34. I was, you know, and the woman I worked at the time for the Rockefeller family up in you know, Rock Center. You know, my whole family, my mother and father all worked for them. So David Rockefeller's secretary was a masseuse for a lot of the guys on Central Park Track Club, and she saw me in the race at about 20, I don't know, somewhere in the park, maybe 24 miles or something. She said, Tony, did you run the whole race? And I said, yes, Carol. And then my father, you know, told her, oh yeah, Tony, you didn't know that Tony was a real good runner, because her and my father were really close friends, you know. My father had worked for the Rockefeller family for many years, and he was explaining to her, and she said, oh my God, you should try out for Central Park Track Club. And I told Carol, I said, well, Carol, I have to tell you that those guys are my biggest rivals. I can't stand those dudes, you know? And she said, oh, well, you should try. They have this new coach. And I explained to her that I ran track. And I said, Central Park doesn't really have a track team. They're like all road guys. And, you know, at the time, you know, the Central Park Track Club history, we had like maybe the best ultra marathon team like in the world at the time. Yeah. So I was like, I don't want to run with those guys. Those guys are slow and, you know, they just run marathons, you know, like I wanted to run track. And then she informed me that they had this new coach who was coming in and that he was bringing in a bunch of Dominicans from his high school, George Washington, where he was the coach. And so that was George Wisniewski, who Frank Handelman recruited, and I said, okay, I mean, I'll go check it out. I didn't have any intentions on really staying, but it was one of those things where, you know, when you know that it's fate, like the minute that I met my coach, he looked at me and he says, oh, Tony Ruiz, Westinghouse High School. I know your whole history. And he started blurting out all my times and, you know, then I went downstairs and, you know, I saw a bunch of guys that I knew from high school that I had run against. And they were all like, you with us? And I said, yeah, this is my first workout. You guys run for Central Park? And they were like, yeah, we came with Wiz. And and the rest is history, pretty much.
Yeah, Brad mentioned George Wisniewski as well. Clearly he had a strong positive impact on a lot of pretty fantastic runners. Now, if you looking back at some of your track races, we don't have unlimited time tonight, but what are one or two that stick out either from high school or with Central Park in your mind?
Well, I would say the one that really sticks out in high school is my Penn Relay 304.2 1200 meter leg, which was at the time when I handed off the baton. I think it was the fifth fastest time ever run at Penn Relays. And my high school team, we were second in the distance medley. So, you know, if I had to pick out one, I would probably pick out that one because, you know, the goal was always to be Penn Relay champions. And we were like, you know, we had a real good shot at the distance medley. And then I ran also back-to-back 154s that same year at Penn Relays. So, you know, my senior year Penn Relay was probably the highlight of my career, you know, although, you know, I mean, I had a lot of, you know, for my freshman year, I won freshman city champs at the cross country.
Was it, I mean, the atmosphere at the Penn Relays must have played into that too, eh? I mean, do you recall, you know, running in the stadium and...
What was that? I'm sorry?
Oh, well, the atmosphere at the Penn Relays, that must have contributed.
Oh, yeah.
So Rats running at Franklin Field, right? In the
Yes, Franklin Field in Pennsylvania, yep, yeah. University of Penn. Yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenal thing. I mean, from the time I went there in ninth grade, we didn't race, but my coach just took us there to watch. And I remember watching the distance medley. I saw this guy, Luis Astolazaga, and Maurice Weaver on anchor leg. And I remember saying to myself, my senior year, we're going to win the distance medley. It was just one of those things, you know, like it was just self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, even though we actually didn't win, we came in second. But to me, so, that was it. Like I wanted to run in front of 50,000 screaming fans.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
that was the goal.
Now you're 304. That's the 1200 leg. So is that the third leg of the race?
Yes.
And then
well,
how close
actually,
did you end up
yes,
being?
It was the third leg. It was the third leg.
How close were you and did your team end up being from first?
Well, when I got the baton, I was in fifth, and when I handed off, we were in first.
Ah, wow. So it was a very glorious leg.
Yes. It was quite a leg. I of course, you know, when you're doing these things, I don't remember anything about it. All I do remember the guy saying my name over the loudspeaker as I was passing everyone on the back straight, and I kind of heard my name, and I just got this infusion of energy and came around the turn and gave our anchor leg, the great Billy Pearson, who was my teammate. This guy Billy Pearson was probably the most talented runner I've ever known, and but he just didn't have it that day, and Bernardsville, you know, beat us on the anchor leg, you know.
Did it come down to the last straightaway, do you recall, or was it not that close?
No. If it would have came down to the last straightaway, Billy would have won because he had, like, this incredible kick. But the coach from Bernardsville was Mark Wetmore. I don't know if
you heard of it. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So he knew that Billy had this kick, so he sent this kid out in two flat, and he basically, you know, took Billy's kick from him, opened up the race, and by the time you know the last quarter, Billy started coming back at him, but it was just too much to make up. You know, I mean, he ran like a 4:16 mile, which is still, you know, pretty good, but it wasn't really his best day. You know, he just didn't have it that day. You know, so we wanted
second.
The second
is not too shabby, and neither is a 4:16. And I guess Wetmore knew what he was doing back then too, huh? Yeah.
Sure. I mean, Bernardsville, that was their first big title at Penn Relays. They wound up winning the distance medley, if I'm not mistaken. I know for sure three times, but it may have been four. But they won a bunch of distance medleys. So he was, you know, he's renowned for being able to develop these great high school milers. You know.
Mm-hmm. What's one race later in life, or maybe even as a masters runner that sticks out?
I'd say that probably the one that for Central Park early in my career was the MAC championships where I ran a 4:14 mile and I won the they had this series that they ran and it was like 1500s and then it would culminate with a mile at the MAC champs.
Mm-hmm.
MAC champs are like the USATF New York And in our day, it was extremely competitive. Like, you know, you'd get guys usually running about 4:05 outdoors, probably close to 4 minutes, you know. So indoors that year, I was leading going into the final, and I needed to get fourth place in the championship race. And I wound up running like a 4:14, which was my, at the time, it was my indoor personal, you know, my PR for my indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And I wound up in fourth place, exactly what I needed, and so I wound up winning that series. But it was probably the one that I remember the most. Although,
yeah, and that got you on the Central Park top 10 list too. You're still there. I think you got the 10th fastest indoor mile for the track club.
I think I'm still in the top 10 there.
Yeah, 4:14.
Yeah, 4:14, and then we also the other one that's really is our first relay title, because we won the 2 mile relay at the MAC Champs, I think the year before, which is when I first came was 81. Mm-hmm. So the 4:14 might have been, was probably 82. But the 81, our first 2 mile relay championship, I'll never forget that one. That was the one that I think I told you, I had a picture of there.
Yeah, yeah.
With the baton coming through the finish.
Yeah.
And that is that was the first relay title in Central Park Track Club history. So that one is always going to, you know, and I anchored that day in something like a 156 at the old Armory floor, which was, you know, that was like the wood track when it was all wood, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, I'd say that those two probably stick out.
Great. And as a Masters runner?
And as a master, I'd say that Puerto Rico 2003, my semifinal race, I had my family there, World Masters Championships.
Uh-huh.
I won my quarterfinal heat. I also won my semifinal heat, which was really nice. And then in the final, I got fourth and sixth in the 1500, and that's the closest that I've come to earning a world championship medal.
Uh-huh.
I've made four finals, so I've been in the top 10, you know, at world four times, but no medal. So that's one that's the elusive one that I'm still every couple of years. Yeah, you know, you get the hunger, and I think that it only happens when the worlds come up, you know?
That's interesting you mentioned. Every couple of years you get the hunger. Is that how you feel right now at your stage of running?
Well, I do feel that way. I think that, you know, over the years, particularly the last 5 years, you know, your body, you start to slow down a little bit. And also, you know, you really, like, I mean, I just, the enjoyment that I get from watching my athletes comparatively is so much more than my own personal goals, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just think that, you know, that it's a natural progression in life, you know?
Yeah.
You get a little older, or maybe, I like to say that you get mature, you know?
right.
And I realize that, you know, my place now as a coach, I'm 55 years old, and, you know, that's where I can give back the most. And to be quite honest, you know, the energy levels, you know, it's harder. And then, you know, you get more injuries, so you got to be careful. So the priorities change, you know. And but I do every once in a while, like cross country season, I always get that you know, I always run cross country. That I'll never miss. You know,
yeah.
Those two or three races at Vanny, I go out there. It's my favorite place to run. But then the world, yeah, I do get that little itch, and I'll train world, you know, well for worlds and. You know, and just, you know, just to see if I can, you know, get that medal. It'd be nice to get one of those one day.
Yeah. Huh. I think you'll do it, Tony. You're still good for podium finishes in the cross country all the time. And, I think it's nice. You still got something to chase.
I do.
I'm gonna bring you to a question that's basically meant for you, because I know you're sort of known for your answer to this, but we ask it of all of our guests. And when Greg and I started the show, Cloud 259, it's because we wanted to break three. Under your tutelage, Tony, I was able to do that. Greg hasn't gotten there yet, so you got to help him. And you got to help all of our listeners try to get their PR in the marathon, whether they're gunning to break three or to break four or to break five or whatever in between. So what we ask all of our guests is, this can be either race day advice or training advice, but what one piece of advice can you give that will help runners achieve a PR in the marathon?
If I had to give one, I mean, and like I said, it's very hard from person to person, it can change.
Yes.
But I would say if it's one, I would say that if you're the type of marathon runner that your final expression race has always been a marathon. In other words, if you're the type of runner that, let's just say you've been running 5 years or 10 years, and you're sort of stuck. That particular type of runner probably needs to work more on speed.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
Maybe take a year off from those marathon miles. Cut the volume. Work on the speed, and then come back to it.
Yep.
So if it's one thing, I would say that if I had to narrow it down, I would say to have a good balance in your training so that, you know, you're still improving in all areas, not just your aerobic levels, but also, you know, your VO2 max, make sure that you're hitting that max. And obviously your lactate threshold, developing your lactate threshold is a key thing. But in order to keep improving that, you have to get quicker. You have to be faster, and so that you can sustain that pace more comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is going to ultimately be the most important thing in terms of running a faster marathon, you know?
What about race day advice?
Race day advice, 10-10-10.
There we go. That's the answer I was looking for. I like your other answer, though. I hadn't heard it, and I completely agree. But for those who haven't heard the 10-10-10, give us your distilled version.
Well, the 10-10-10 is basically you break the race down into three parts, first 10 miles, second 10 miles, and last 10K. And this thing really just was devised for the New York City Marathon, specifically. You can use it for any race, obviously, but the whole goal of the 10-10-10 is to run the first 10 miles 3 to 5 seconds slower than your overall goal pace. So if you're trying to run, you know, let's just say 6:30 pace. So you'd want to run about 6:33, 6:35 for those first 10 miles. Then the middle 10 miles, you're going to run just under or right around your goal pace, maybe a little bit quicker. So you're going to go from 6:35 maybe to 6:27. So you're running slightly quicker. Generally speaking, what that's going to do is it's going to give you momentum. By the last 10K, the whole point to it is that those seconds, even though it doesn't seem like a lot, when you add it all up, it's probably only about less than a minute, really, you know, in the first 10-mile phase.
Yeah.
But in terms of – it's not a lot in terms of raw time, but in terms of energy reserves – it's amazing how many people, you know, like say a person that's running 6:30, if they run 6:25, by the time they get to 10 miles, they're basically running at very extreme oxygen debt already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even the best trained athlete, you know, once you get to 10 miles, 15 miles, particularly 20 miles, because you really are going to slow down, so you always want to stay with that clip, you know.
Yeah.
And that's usually why people hit the wall. And New York City is such a tough last 10K that you always want to hit the 20-mile mark with having a little momentum, you know, because you know, as you know, that race is physical, but mostly mental, you know, because.
Yeah.
Anyone who attempts to do a marathon is in pretty good shape, especially if you're, you know, like a serious runner who's running 3 hours or doing 50, 60 miles. So
right.
At the end of the day, it's always about the proper execution on race day. And I found that over the years, you know, it just ensures that you don't have a major blow up because, you know, if there's one thing that you hate is to see a runner you know, train, and then their final expression race winds up being, you know, 30 minutes slower than what they could run. Right. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's I've all been about there recently. Yeah. Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah. Yeah.
So we always want to avoid that, you know, and this way you have a better chance. Of course, you know, you also are going to probably finish strong, and then that's going to sort of set the stage for your next cycle of training. So oftentimes I'll get people to say, oh, man, you know, I had so much left in the tank. It was amazing, but I probably left a minute out there. And I'll just say, well, that's a great thing, because now you're going into this next cycle knowing that you still have, you know?
Yeah.
You still have not run at your optimal best. And eventually, you know, you will get to the point where the more experience you get, the less you have to rely on that 10-10-10 mentality, you know?
Yeah.
But it's always good, particularly on bad days, like if the weather's not great or if it's too hot, you know, then the 10-10-10 is really critical, you know?
So the 10-10-10, basically you're saying you go slower the first 10 miles in your race pace, and then what, about at race pace for the mid-10, and then the last 10K you're racing?
You know, you're going a little faster than your goal pace in the middle 10, you know, and then at the end, then at the last 10K, you're going at goal pace.
Oh, I see. Got it.
Yeah, so you make up the minute on the front end in the middle,
uh-huh.
Right? In the middle 10, you make that up. And then, so when you get to 20, you're basically even at goal pace. And then you just run the last 10K at goal pace. But I think that if you use that type of approach, what happens is that when you get to 20 miles, the biggest thing that you're going to get from this is that you're going to be passing people.
Yeah.
Because you're running faster than you've run the previous 10 miles. So you're going to see that you start to pass people. So everyone starts to tire.
Yeah.
But a big part of that race is the mental part at 20 miles. And in New York, as you know, 22, 23 miles, when you get up on Fifth Avenue, you know, even if you have a little bit left and you're still passing people, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to still be able to push through, whereas if you're not passing people and people are just passing you, then you just kind of throw in the towel at that point.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think when you're still competing, when you're still feeling that spirit of competition in the park, it's a wonderful feeling in the marathon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nothing like...
If you take it up too fast, it's very easy to be cooked before that happens.
Yeah. Well, like the great Alan Rubin says, he says, you know, take the bus to 24 miles, you know, and then at 24 miles, you know, you bring out, you get the game face and you start to race from there.
Tony, so, I can't thank you enough for coming on our show. Thank you so much. Great advice, wisdom for us all. I look forward to getting back out there to the next workout. So we'll see you at Central Park, or we'll see you up at the Armory.
Well, look forward to seeing you, and thank you for having me on.
So thanks again both to Brad and to Tony for sharing their time with us and for telling us a lot of stories. For those of you who started listening to this episode when you started your run, you're probably at least 10 or 12 miles in, but that's how we like to play it. Now, Greg, I guess we need to talk about New York a little bit.
Yes, we do.
I'll tell you, I was thinking about this today. So for listeners who don't know what happened, I was trained, I thought, for another run at 3, breaking 3. I was close last year in 2015, running 3:01. And my training, I thought, was at least on par with that. Maybe it was a little bit loaded toward the end. I did a lot of hard training toward the end. But my October 2016 was better than my October 2015. And I had done some once a week strength work at the Y. So I thought I was in good shape. And in the race, I felt decent through 14, and then I hit the Queensboro Bridge. And, you know, when you're on that bridge, I think you can tell kind of how your race is going. And
that's the moment of truth.
Yeah, it's a moment of truth for sure. Maybe not for everyone, maybe not all the time, but for me it was. And I wasn't passing people like I thought I would be doing. And I also was cognizant in the race, I was keeping it very under control, and I was going to start opening up a little bit once I got to the top, and I was never able to open up because I was already declining. And that was disappointing. Up First Avenue, I tried to conserve, so I consciously slowed down. And Greg, I know you were tracking, so you probably saw that, you know, the 650s turned into 720s or 730s. But I was doing this because I thought, okay, this is the wise strategy because I'm going to conserve a bit, and that way I won't feel as bad in the Bronx, and then I'll be able to finish. So I reset my expectations maybe or hopes for or goal for a 310 at that point. And then in the Bronx, you know, it just got worse. And then I knew my sister would be cheering, Polly, who we've had on the show and we've mentioned on the show frequently, after I got out of the Bronx, and I saw her, and that was great. And that was about the last thing I needed to see. That was about the last time I retained my dignity on the course, I think. Once I hit Marcus Garvey Park, I just, you know, I was tempted to stop running, and I've never walked at the New York City Marathon. I've run, I don't know, a half dozen of these by now. And it was like in Boston, on the Hot Boston, when I walked. I didn't decide to walk until the step that I, you know, until I did it. And at that point, my thought process was my back and my neck was really hurting. I was very stiff in the shoulders, and this started earlier, like on the Queensboro. My back was hurting, and the backs of my legs were really hurting. So the backs of my legs felt really tight. And I thought at that point, if I keep running, now this was my justification, but this is just, you know, how it goes in these things. If my justification was that if I keep running, I will definitely need to go to the medical tent, and it's not going to be pretty. If I walk, I might be able to start running again, and at least I will still probably go to the medical tent, but it won't be that bad.
Well, you always go to the medical tent, Bren. It should be named after you. It'd be the Bren Jones Medical Tent.
All right, you got me there. But it was levels of medical tentness. And your race didn't go well, and maybe that planted a tiny seed. But the important seed is that at this age and stage of life, you don't want to completely mess yourself up.
Yeah.
For a race that's not going in your direction. And so I started walking, and I started to feel a little bit better. And then there was some sort of dark humor in it. I thought about how, you know, when things die, they feed the earth. And in a way, I had died on the course in a sense, and I was feeding the race because, you know, I had always seen roadkill in the marathon, but besides that Hot Boston, I'd never been one. And, you know, the roadkill feeds the race because other runners are passing you, and for them, you know, they're doing relatively well to you. And for people who might not have expected to beat you, if they pass you, maybe that gives them a little lift or something. I don't know.
So you're being generous. You're lifting other people's spirits by walking, and they were passing you.
Yeah, it's all part of the great justification for walking.
I love it. No, I like it.
There was one other part of dark humor in the race, Greg, and it turned out to be even darker. And that was, you know, I was thinking, okay, well, even though this is a really horrible race, at least in a few days, we won't have to hear about Donald Trump anymore because Hillary Clinton's going to be president. And if I could have either a good race and Trump is president or a bad race and Clinton is president, maybe I'd take a bad race and Clinton is president.
Unfortunately, you didn't have that choice.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking maybe we won't have to hear Donald Trump's name through all media for the next 4 years. But lest I contribute to that problem, moving on. There were a few North Brooklyn runners walking up Fifth Avenue, up the incline there. And then there was another humorous moment because I thought, oh, okay, good. I can make some friends. Like, you know, it's late in the race. I want to chat with these people. I want to share this disappointment. So I sort of walked as fast as I could to catch up to them. And right as I caught them, they started running again. So that was a fail. There were a few people holding signs. After I started walking, I started noticing the crowd a lot more. And there were a few people holding signs that said, like, punch here for power, or, like, you know, power button. And And then I did punch them. Like, I, you know, I sort of got into it. Like, yeah, okay, yeah. I showed absolutely no dignity at the Central Park Track Club Wall of Orange. I think maybe I tried to jog. I don't even know. I mean, my race was shot. With about a mile, with a bit more than a mile left. So I'd walked from miles 22 to 25. I thought, okay, let me try to run the rest of this. And I was able to run the last mile, like a slow jog, you know. And I was able to cross the finish line feeling in one piece. And then one of the highlights of the day was that Jared Ward was there, the U.S. Olympian, who came in sixth at the Olympics in the marathon. And he gave me my medal. And that was fantastic. And I, you know, yeah, he put it over my neck. And like, and I thought it was kind of cool, too, because I recognized him. I knew who he was. So he said, congratulations. And I knew that for me, it was... It was a disappointing race, but I was like, well, no, congratulations to you. I said, you had an awesome race. And I think that picked him up. You know, I think it couldn't have made him sad hearing that, right? I mean, he must have been happy to be recognized. So that was a nice moment. It was great.
That's
and,
you very
know, and
cool.
I'm thinking in my head, why the heck haven't we had this guy on the show yet? Like,
you know, you should have said that. Why didn't you ask? You should have.
We can tell him when we do land him on the show, we can tell him the story.
I'm just glad you didn't throw up on his head or something like that.
Yeah. So I walked and my bag was in like the last truck, and I did end up going into the medical tent. You know, I almost made it, but it was a pretty long walk, and went into the medical tent, and you know, one of the medical students who helped me out, as it turns out, she was a figure skater who almost made the Olympics herself and just missed and was disappointed. And so, I mean, I don't know. They were just good conversations I had with people. It all became more of a, like once I started walking, it was no longer a scene of trying to shut everything out and just stay in the zone, and more a scene of bringing everything in. But I really don't want to do that again. I mean, I don't, maybe in future races, I'll allow more in and maybe be less fixated on being in a zone. I don't know. But
yeah,
you know, the walking experience, I don't really want to repeat it. It's an experience. I mean, it's still a marathon. It's still, I'm still proud of the race in a way. You know, I finished and I was, I had a kind of a cool time in the end, like what it was like 3:33:11, I think, right?
It was a full house. Yeah.
Yeah. 3:33:11.
Yeah.
And you know, my goal was to break three. I ran 3:33. Okay. But I was surprised when I looked at the overall results. I think I was still, I don't know, maybe 5,000th or something. Like I wasn't, I tried for the top 1,000 and I wasn't quite as far down as I thought I would be in the, compared to the whole field. Mm-hmm. So it still was like an okay time.
Of course it was.
And I guess for me too, it wasn't my most disappointing race. Maybe I have more perspective now, or maybe somewhere in the back of my head, I knew I was a little bit tired. Like I had that feeling during the race that this is the last New York City Marathon I'm not going to run it in 2017. I had that feeling. Like I've run several in a row now. This is the last I'm going to run. And now that I've run 3:33, I look back at those other races and I think, wow, that like a 3:08 is better than I thought it was when I ran the 3:08. You know.
Right. Right. I know what you mean. Well, I definitely know what you mean about that.
Yeah. But I will say, I do want to keep it real a bit and give some lessons. Like we don't have many trials on this, so we don't really know what worked and what didn't work. But I'll tell you what did not work this time. And that was that I did the Staten Island half, which was my best race of the year, I think, in 1:24 something in bad weather conditions. Then I did a 18 mile at marathon pace. 2 weeks before the race. And I think at that point, people would have told me, you shouldn't do that. And it worked last year. It worked in 2015. It did not work in 2016. After that run, that 18 at marathon pace, and I was thrilled that I was able to do it. And I did it in decent time. And I felt like, okay, you know, I'm ready. And then I had a pretty big taper. I didn't have a run after that that felt easier than it should have, or to put it another way, every run felt a bit tougher than it should have. I did one where I thought I was going marathon pace and I was going for a few miles and I was going 7:10, 7:20, not 6:50. So October was my best training month, the month before the marathon. I had 250 miles. Other months I had maybe 200, but that did not work for me. So, you know, though I didn't cram the last 2 weeks, I crammed in the month up to the last 2 weeks. And I think the year that it really worked, I had a 18-week, or I started running good mileage, like mid to high 50s in June. So it a longer, higher volume training cycle is what I need to do well. And the other takeaway I have is I'm 42 now. I'm going to be 43 soon. Like, I need to actually have a better training cycle, significantly better training cycle than before to expect the same result. For us, 3 hours is an obvious target. For me, it was an obvious target. I talked to a guy in the corral who beat me, or who I was comparable with at Staten Island. And I figured, I said, "Hey, what are you aiming for?" And I figured he was aiming for sub 3:02. And he said, "Oh, 3:10. That's interesting. Like, why is he aiming for 3:10 and I'm aiming for 3 if we're comparable level?" And so I think, you know, if I'm in fantastic, amazing shape, then yeah, I'll make sub 3 my goal, or even better my goal if I'm in just out of the world shape. But I can't go in the same shape I was in before and expect to run sub 3. I think it's sort of, you know, I should just run the race and see what happens.
Right. I think you're right about having like a more extended period of high volume to have it really sink in, and not just have like one or two good, you know, weeks that give you an indication. So look, great race. I was kidding about the medical tent. You've had races where you've had great performances and had the medical tent, but you tend to give it your all. So it doesn't, no slight on you. But the other thing I wanted to mention is Ed Whitlock, the 84-year-old who ran a 3:54. He ran his second half faster than both of us. So, well, I'm always here to make you feel good, Bren.
Hats off to Ed Whitlock. He's another guy we should get on the show. But it was interesting, Greg, how our races were similar, you know, and it's I'm trying to get at what was it about late in the race that, you know, what broke me? And it's just interesting. It's a tough thing to get your head around when you know you're broken in a marathon. Mm-hmm. And it's particularly tough to get your head around when the first 10 miles of the race, I was just thinking very consciously, keep the brakes on. Like, I'm running slowly now so that I can be running at this same pace later in the race. And later in the race, it will be very fast relative to other people. So when you're thinking that during the beginning of the race, but then that's not what happens, it's tough, but it's not easy.
And it's almost impossible. I've never been able to do what you tried to do after mile 16, which is decelerate strategically. It seems like it's by that time, it's just too late. You know, your fate is sealed. It makes sense on paper, but it just seems like by the time we realize we have to slow down, it's too late. I think the only thing to do about that is to be a little bit more conservative, but I don't know. You know, the marathon is a mystery, and you don't want to give up, you know, the possibility of a very good performance where we're negative splitting, which does happen. Not as often, but it does happen. So I don't know. I think it's all that comes down to preparation and a long extended period of putting the work in, not just two great long runs, but three or four great long runs and just, feeling completely prepared. I think, in all honesty, we were both underprepared.
I totally agree. The race requires a lot of preparation, and it requires a longer training cycle than I gave it. I thought maybe with three decent months and, you know, I don't know. I can't shortcut it. You know, there are people who have great ability, who can run faster than me for sure. But, for me, I need the higher volume for longer. At least that's what the results have shown.
All right, Bren, let's get ready for the next show. Let's do more in 2017 and better marathons.
Better marathons.
And I will see you on the other side of this inauguration.
Oh,
From the mountain to the prairie.